You had mentioned some key dates or, things to talk about. Timeframe, the National Broadband Plan was, I believe, 2011. And so that had chapters on each of these things, like education and healthcare. And it really talked about like creating new avenues and commodities around the digitization of these services. So, it's really important to understand that this infrastructure for capital flows, is running through the telecommunications, is running through the FCC, and is it's companies working, the government, federal government working hand in hand with the corporate interests. So the corporate interest, that plan was to advance broadband and essentially to run our life through broadband. And in Philadelphia, we're the home of Comcast, right? So the two largest skyscrapers in the city are Comcast, and they built the second one. And I'm like, I point that out and I say, oh, they built that second skyscraper to channel our life through it. And it actually has this like glowing finger. It's kind of like a middle finger sticking up. There's like one looks like a thumb drive and one looks like a middle finger to the city. So yeah, so that's Comcast, Comcastic. And the other piece is, in terms of legislation, the piece that set up EdTech and this idea of badging was Executive Order 13111, and it was Bill Clinton. And I'm trying to remember the exact year. I think 19, I don't know, maybe it might have been 1999. So this executive order essentially set up what's called the Advanced Distributed Learning Program. It also set up a task force to talk about using technology to train all Americans for lifelong learning. Okay? ADL came out of the military, so it's very important to understand that the educational technology space is inherently, from the beginning, a military space, always has been. Came out of the Department of the Defense, and this idea was that distance learning was useful for the military, for people in naval submarines who needed to learn new software programs. And that not only was it great for the military, but that it was great for all federal employees, and in fact, it was just great for all Americans. And so this Advanced Distributed Learning Program has four regional offices. There's an administrative one in Alexandria. There's one at University of Wisconsin-Madison, which is the academic one, but it also has a lot of gaming. There's one in Memphis, which is workforce development. And then there's one in Orlando, which is military, but that's also gaming. So all of these systems were set up to talk about how do we use technology to train the U.S. population for lifelong learning, which, while it sounds great, like you think of very like, hey, we can learn our whole life, right? Like our brains don't dry up like when we're 19 or whatever. Like, it sounds good, but what they really mean is reskilling for a global gig economy. Like, that's their lifelong learning, is us to continually be remade as human capital and continue to chase jobs that will be going away because they are automated, and then be reskilling again. And then understanding that the hedge funds are betting on the reskilling part, with the success metrics will very likely be acquiring the badge, acquiring the credential, not actually getting employment, right? So we'll just be collecting our chits and our skill credit badges in our learning lockers, but we'll never actually get to do the work, because by the time we've got the skill, the robot's doing that job, we got to do the next skill. And then the hedge funds are just on the side betting on whether or not we will comply and get the damn badge. So that's like the game that we're in. And it's really interesting, because I will say, like a number of years ago, I was lobbying against these high school exit exams in our city council. I was in City Hall and I saw our council president, who was my city council person, Darren Clark, and I was saying, these Keystone exit exams are a terrible thing. They really don't represent what kids can do. And he's like, well, we need them, and we're an eds and meds economy. We're going to be eds and meds. And I'm like, oh, eds and meds, right? And so what happened, though, is what I've realized over the last few years is, like, you hear eds and meds and you think, like, oh, they want a bunch of teachers and healthcare workers, right? Like, that's eds and meds. It's an economy of eds and meds. No, I'm pretty sure what they mean is we are to be processed by eds and meds. We're not the processors. We're the product. We will be managed as chronically ill people. We will be managed as chronically underemployed or unemployed people through the educational systems that are being set up through digital platforms and through digital systems that are telemedicine and also teletherapy. So there might be a few people running the platforms and monitoring the data analytics, but increasingly all of this stuff is going to be automated. So eds and meds is not what they I mean, maybe they're actually believing what they're saying, but understanding the system, it means that we're just going to be the raw product to be processed through in this sort of post-Fordist world by these technological systems under the heading of education and healthcare, which are those UN Sustainable Development Goals. So a lot of what's happening now is connected to debt, not surprisingly, and student debt. The Lumina Foundation is connected to this, which is based in Indianapolis, is a debt company. They're very much involved in the push for competency-based education. This debt will start to manifest in new forms, and one of these new forms is called the Income Sharing Agreement, or an ISA. And there's a model in Purdue, is called Back a Boiler, where you have someone invest in your education and you agree to share a portion of your income with this person, like over time. But only certain types of degrees are attractive and get certain amounts of, there are deals, there are contract deals set up. And this will likely happen through blockchain, these blockchain ledgers. And so there's an organization called Institute for the Future, which has a series of little videos. One of them is called Learning is Earning, which talks about learning on blockchain. And then there's other videos that talk about income sharing agreements. They're very short clips. But in the income sharing agreement one, it was a young woman who was debating getting a virtual reality degree or a degree in Chinese because, you know, one, she could self-finance, and one, she had to take an income sharing agreement with, but one paid better. And she was like debating in this video what she should do. So we have to know about the reskilling programs, the debt programs that Lumina is connected. The other piece of this is understanding workforce development that we're moving towards under the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, that I believe was 2014, that Obama oversaw, was a shift towards planned regional economies, which is something I don't think most people are aware of. And I mentioned that earlier, that our Southeastern Pennsylvania WIOA plan anticipated the high growth areas were mostly gig economy and very low wage jobs. What they are putting in place is this idea that within certain regions, there will be designated job opportunities, like 6 or 8. And like, if you're living in that region, like that's what you're trained for, which is kind of incredible that that would happen here and that people really wouldn't be talking about it. But these jobs and the skill codes for every job are connected through something called ONET, which is tied to the Department of Labor, and it's this computing system in Raleigh. So this idea that all these jobs have skill codes and that the codes will be mediated probably through algorithmic systems, through welfare to work programs most likely, again, all feeding data analytics and labor market analytics. Like that's what this ed tech model is feeding into an economy where labor is redundant. People will be profiled from very early ages onto certain tracks, where access to jobs, like I don't know what happens if you move out of your region. Like I used to think like, oh, well, what if you're trained up in Southeastern Pennsylvania and you want to move to the Bay Area, but I don't know, maybe in pandemic we're not allowed to move anymore. Like maybe we never get to leave our region. It is Hunger Games and we're just stuck in our region. Like I was like, oh, what has happened? Like here are your 8 jobs that you can do in Southeastern Pennsylvania, and there's like only 2 overlapping jobs in the region you want to move to. Like it's very incredible, but this is real and is happening, and all of the workforce training boards are aligning to this. So there's a letter that's really important to read. Mark Tucker was connected to the National Center for Education and the Economy, and he was part of an organization like the Alliance for Restructuring Education that got its start in the late 1980s. National Center for Education and the Economy was the early 90s. He wrote a letter to Hillary Clinton when Bill Clinton was elected to the presidency, essentially outlining the intention of U.S. Chamber of Commerce interests to remake the national workforce program in a way that was aligned to this apprenticeship model and a planned workforce development model. And it was read into the congressional record a ways later, so you can actually read the letter, the actual letter, which is really vital because at this point, what we're seeing in workforce-based learning, competency-based education, skills badging, profiling students from these early ages is all embedded in this letter from the mid-1990s. And that's so we're here. Like, and it's called the Dear Hillary Letter. And it's advanced by many on the conservative side because it was a letter. And she didn't ask for this letter. It was merely like sort of their assertion of the Chamber of Commerce of how they should proceed. But in lockstep, no matter what presidential administration, we have been continuously advancing. And so that now what we're seeing is something called adoption of the Swiss model, the Swiss apprenticeship model. In Switzerland, you have to understand, is the home of blockchain, the Zug crypto valley and central banking. I think people think Swiss model and they're like, oh, we can be a pastry chef. It'll be great. Like, I love apprenticeships. It's great. Like, we don't all have to like go to four-year college, which is true. But essentially the jobs are going to be linked into these very limited workforce options determined by regions and will very most likely be aligned to STEM careers that support the fourth industrial revolution, those goals, which is the primacy of STEM, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and building the virtual world, I think, and securing it through cybersecurity. That's what they want people to do, and that's what people will be forced to do through these lifelong badging programs. ADL, Advanced Distributed Learning, like was integrated with something called IMS Global, which is the badging system. And these badges, early on, there was something called SCORM. I think it was like the Shareable Content Object Reference Module, which was an early learning management system. That's how you interfaced with like an online learning system like Dreambox or something on a laptop. But that technology didn't work for non-computer based. It didn't work on phones and it didn't work on tablets and it didn't work on wearable technology, and they needed to capture especially behavioral data beyond the limits of the traditional learning management system. So SCORM was sort of built upon, and I think it's being sort of set aside now, with something called XAPI or Tin Can API, which allows for the capture of information and uploading to learning lockers from wearable technologies and these other systems, like from phone-based learning. And this is all, again, embedded in military training, but not just military training. And so the XAPI is based on something called, like, it has a noun verb object, and it essentially reduces education to something like, I did this. I read this book. I accomplished this level in the martial arts game. You know, I caught three fish and I took a picture of it with my video camera and uploaded it. Like, every life has to be reduced into this box of the noun verb object, and that is what XAPI is. And my feeling, and I haven't proven this, but it seems very consistent, that XAPI will be linked to these Ethereum smart contracts, both for payment processing and credentialing. So you'll be like, I went to the rock climbing wall and I got certified that I got to the top of this skill level, and then you like, I did this, and that goes in your learning locker, and the rock climbing wall gets paid, you get the skill, and all the data gets tracked, and the investor who is investing in your physical education like gets paid back, and it's all on the ledger, and it's all very trusting and very transparent, and essentially we become like pawns in their video game world. And we're not in control of the video game world. We're just told to, we've given a path and we got to be on their path. Yeah. And so this is where I think like the liberation aspect comes. I mean, that's the Freirean, this is being imposed by an anti-life engineering militarized force across the world. This isn't US versus China. This is us in solidarity with the Uyghurs, in solidarity with the Palestinians, in solidarity with the families in Boa Vista, the families of North Philadelphia. We all, the people who are being dispossessed off their lands in India, we're all in this together against this system that would seek to reduce our lives to fit in this I did this box to profit hedge funds. And knowing some of the hedge funds are betting against us. Betting against our health, betting against our education, betting against our well-being, betting against our housing, betting against all of it. They will say that they're just betting for us. But for every person betting for us, there's somebody betting against us.
Heads, I win. Tails, you lose.
Yeah, right? But people don't think of it like that. They don't know the history. They're caught up in the partisan nature. And, you know, I will say, like my values are understanding this is a problem of institutional structural racism, of genocide, of human capital finance, of all of these things. And I'm sure, like, which is not to say if we get beyond the part, like, that I'm in agreement with all these other people, but I'm sure many people out there would want to fight this and not share those values. Those are my values. This is the people I want to stand up with. And this is who I want to ally with. So, sorry.
One of the things I think a lot about, assuming that everyone had good intentions, including Bill Gates and everyone, they really just want to make the world a better place, which I don't think that's the case. But let's just give them the benefit of the doubt that that's the case. I think a lot about like Hegelian dialectic. And so there's this relationship, there's a conversation, you know, the thesis, antithesis, but together it creates a synthesis. And I think about the Hippocratic Oath. First thing they say is do no harm. Yet we have a system that does immense amounts of harm for profit, and then we're gonna come in after the fact and then remedy some of that harm with some of the profits that are made from that system. And together you're creating a synthesis, that there's a relationship, there's a direct relationship between the harm that's being done and the supposed good that's being done, that is your thesis and the antithesis, but together it creates a whole. And the idea of coming up with solutions that circumvent or completely step outside of that dialectic. That was kind of I don't know if that's a question there, but like, I guess it was more of a like, what are your thoughts on that kind of idea? Like, is there a better way to approach these? Again, because I'm like coming at this from, let's just say Bill Gates has good intentions. He's going to make a bunch of money doing damage through Monsanto and all this other shit, but then he's going to do some good, assuming that, you know, giving him the benefit.
Well, they're creating
of the doubt.
Markets, right? I mean, they're the markets. I wrote a post that kind of riffed off of this Twilight Zone episode where the aliens come in and they have this book and people are not sure what to make of this book. And you know, at the end, the aliens convince most of the folks it's all good and they're getting on the spaceship. And the woman who's been working really hard to crack the code to translate this book, because additionally, the cover of the book, it says to serve man, right? And they're like, oh, these people must be awesome to serve man. And like at the end, like as they're getting on the ship, she's running out going, wait, it's a cookbook, you know? And that's how I feel, is that these markets are fueled on misery. And we live in a world where there is enough, where there could be abundance, but we are, our systems, imperial systems of domination, are invested in militarism and an extractivism and causing these terrible damages. And those of us who are living sort of in the belly of this beast, and you know, we have caused grave harm around the world, and we're part of these things like the World Bank and structural adjustment that are continuing to cause this great harm. You know, when we're in this moment, you know, of climate, you know, the environment is being devastated, and we need to make a different choice. I mean, those of us who see it have to make a different choice, I feel like. And I think the dialectic for me is that, and I think I mentioned it before, but it's this idea of this life force, that there is this very direct life force that the technology wants to channel it into their circuits and harness it. You know, it's like a, you know, damming it up, you know, this water wheel, like to use it to power things for their benefit. And that the antithesis to that is an open flowing system that in its power of flowing through these interconnections, like continues to build more power, like by feeding off of each other, like supporting one another, as opposed to channeling things off into all these separate little boxes and holding it hostage. And I don't know if that's the right way to see it, but I do feel like there is a spiritual element of this, and I think it sits at the intersection of like physics and mathematics and spirit and faith, which is an interesting place. And I just a couple years ago I read it, and then I gave a copy away, so I got another copy of A Wrinkle in Time, which is a book I read as a kid, and you know, it's about this journey into sort of other dimensions with, you know, guidance from outside beings. And they talk about the Tesseract, and which is sort of this way of transporting into different dimensions. And you know, what they're up against is something called IT, you know, which is a technocracy, really. Is that at the end of the book, that's what they're up against. And the only thing that can come up against that is love, you know, and in the end, love prevails in a way that, and, you know, the book is very much about physics and math and love. So I feel like I don't know how it's all going to play out. And this is, you know, I'm just on this journey. I just thought I was fighting standardized testing. I thought it was going to be one thing, and it was like something very different. I never thought about, you know, cyborg evolution. You know, wherever these crazy people seem to think things are going. But I take a lot of hope in that, like, they don't expect a lot of people to confront them on this. The ripple effect that small groups of individual people can have is pretty profound. And I look to see, like, even in the lead up to this situation now, like over the winter, the stand that was taken by Wet'suwet'en Nation, you know, in the lands that are called, you know, British Columbia, like against those pipeline companies, and these women, these mothers and grandmothers in ceremony against these very powerful forces, like rippled out across Canada and into the US and their allies, and having that strength of spirit and fortitude in the face of something and is very inspirational. And I think that is something to tap into. And I will say, and I know you're not that political about things, but I've been looking for the answer, because for a long time I just were like, let me tell you all the horrible things. And people are like, oh, Allison, with all the horrible things. You know, and it's like, it is kind of depressing. And I'm like, and I don't know what the answer is, because, you know, I don't know how to build the answer by myself, because it has to be a collective vision. Like, I can't just say, and here's my answer, because like that would be totally the opposite of everything I'm saying. Is that there is a group called Eco-Socialist Horizons that has developed a 500-year plan that is land-based and indigenous-centered, and they're looking to try to heal the earth from this stuff with these, and they, you know, so I think there are people out there who have ideas about what to do, and we have to realize there's not going to be any quick fix. So the life of those of us who are already, you know, I'm 51, whatever, you know, I don't know how much time I have left. But if I can use that time to be in struggle in some positive way towards that end, like, that's the best I could do.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned Wrinkle in Time. I read that when I was a kid. I don't really remember it that well. But they just came out with a movie that I think Oprah Winfrey produced, which is like,
yeah, I know.
Oprah is like, you couldn't get more.
Well, she goes to the Robin Hood galas. Well, the thing is, but you need to hijack the thing. Like, that's the things. You know, when you see it over and over again, is that when things push the envelope, they get pulled back in. They get pulled back in certain ways. And I have to say, like, where things are moving right now with the virtualization of the real world, the gamification of the real world. I mean, the gaming industry, the video gaming industry is a huge part of this. Epic Games and Fortnite, you know, they want to take over education, so everyone will build ostensibly what they say is their video games, but I think what they really mean is the next world.
So how what's their involvement, Epic Games and Fortnite? You want to just say a couple words
about
what they're doing?
So Epic Games, one of the major video game companies, is based in Raleigh-Durham. They came to Philly in 2016 during the Democratic National Convention and were at an event I was at. The Atlantic Magazine was hosting all these different talking things, and it was about education in the creative economy. And they had Suzanne DelBene, who's a former Microsoft congresswoman from Washington State, there, and this woman who is from University of Wisconsin-Madison, who's a big gaming person, who's now at UC Irvine, I think, and one of our council people, and the guy who is the president of Epic Games. And essentially, this talk that was ostensibly supposed to be about education in the creative economy was about how to get kids trained up to build their video games, which was kind of strange, to think about that. And it took me a couple years to realize it wasn't actually the games that they're planning for us to code the virtual world, like the world as a game. But the company, even though it's based in Raleigh-Durham, a little over 40% of it is owned by Tencent, which is one of the largest companies in China. And they have their own social credit scoring system, and I believe WeChat Pay, like digital payment systems and gaming economies. And they were able to scale. Fortnite is a multiplayer warlike video game. I do not play it, but I understood it took the world by storm. All these little kids, like tiny elementary school kids, were like up late into the night playing these war games. And that game was essentially scaled with Chinese capital. And then what Epic Games has actually done is they've created beyond their gaming something called the Unreal Engine, which is a software platform that allows for the creation in real time of like virtualized experiences and almost synthetic people. And so they're sort of franchising the use of this Unreal Engine for a lot of different programs, everything from like advertising, but also to education and healthcare. They're like, it's great, we'll just have synthetic people. So they're collaborating with Disney. And so as we're moving into these worlds where we're not sure what's real and what's not real and who's a human and who isn't a human, and there's humanoid robots, there's humanoid avatars. Facebook is rolling out these, you know, new avatars. We're virtualizing ourselves. We need to understand the role of the video game companies in the virtual world space. And also, there's an important piece, which is the Institute for Creative Technologies, which is based out of USC. And that was created in the late 1990s by the US Army Research Lab and a guy who was one of the head designers for Disney. And they've collaborated to essentially on virtual simulation. Because they're like, how can the entertainment industry work really well with the military? Because we both really want to do simulation. And so for the last 20 years, they've been refining technologies to create virtualized environments and synthetic people. So, and as we interact with synthetic people, especially in like therapeutic settings, or educational settings, like it is not clear how much behavioral biometric data is being pulled in, how that's going to feed markets in human capital and predictive analytics on people, predictions about people's mental health, like how it's going to feed into policing. Like there are just many, many like ethical things, especially when like fundamentally it's funded by the Army. The Army and Disney, go figure, right?
Yeah, sounds pretty good, huh?
That was bad Mickey Mouse.
So if you think about capital, like where capital lives, and the foundations are a piece of it, and the foundations are using their assets to catalyze these markets, because right now the markets can't stand alone. So they use the assets of the foundations to underpin the markets until the markets can take. There's a chunk of money in pension funds, right? So all of these ed tech situations that are essentially going to start replacing teachers with online platforms are backed by the leadership of the national teachers unions, which sounds kind of bizarre. Like, why would the leadership of the national teachers unions be backing platforms that are putting human teachers out of work? But if you understand that, like, TIAA CREF and SEIU and the teachers' pension funds are going to be investing in the human capital, like that those pension funds need the community schools in place to invest in all of the human capital wraparound services, and invest in the high impact learning technologies, that's why the union, like we're not able to count on union leadership at all to resist this program, because they've already signed up for something called Education Reimagined that happened several years ago. So the leadership is all on board, and the rank and file union members just don't even know. The other piece, there's a big chunk in insurance premiums. So the big insurance companies have this big chunk of capital to pour in. So a lot of the healthcare systems like Kaiser Permanente and companies that are invested in insurance, they're going to be, like you're hearing about insurance companies investing in pay-for-success supportive housing. Because they'll say, oh, look, we're offsetting chronic illness by providing housing. But essentially, they're going to create housing that are data pods. So there's insurance. There's sovereign wealth funds, like the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund. That's a big one. They're investing in a lot of impact investing opportunities. But then the Vatican Bank is actually a major player in this space. And it's important to think about because the Pope actually has very close connections with Microsoft. And Bill Gates is a practicing Catholic. And I'm not anti-Catholic. I'm just saying faith communities with large endowments will be major players in this space. And many of the entities that are a lot of ed tech and digital identity systems are operating out of Salt Lake City, which is one of the ARPA nodes. But there's a lot of money in Latter-day Saints money holdings for these impact. And you know, the religious groups would like nothing more than to say they're doing well by doing good and both manage society according to their behavioral pathway that they deem fit. So the Vatican has held three social impact conferences in coordination with the Mendoza Business School at Notre Dame. And Piero Mediar, Tom Steyer, they've all been in on this mix and setting up the digital identity systems. And many of the impact opportunities that are advancing are happening through the Jesuit universities and the Catholic Relief Services specifically. So the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Chair, Patrick Harker, he is a Wharton professor, but he was also on the board of Catholic Relief Services. So that they are based in Baltimore. And I sort of say this going in, talking about like what does it mean if you're put on a pathway that has a faith-based component, right? That may or may not align with your own personal belief system. There's a lot going on in Baltimore. So Johns Hopkins is in Baltimore. Johns Hopkins has very close ties to public health, these vaccination programs, Michael Bloomberg, state surveillance, the NSA. A lot of that is going on with Johns Hopkins. Also, Catholic Relief Services is based in Baltimore. The other big entity that's based in Baltimore is the Casey, the Annie E. Casey Foundation. So Annie E. Casey, when I was looking at it, at their board, which is how I sort of do things, is like, oh, who are the people that are connected to this? The vast majority of people on their board were all tied to UPS. And I was like, well, that's it. Like, because usually boards are a little more diverse than like having half the people tied to UPS. Well, it turns out the Annie E. Casey Foundation came out of UPS money. That the man who founded it, he founded UPS. His mother was a single parent, and he was very involved in foster children. And so the Annie Casey Foundation is very much connected to UPS. And they actually were the ones who created early on, I think it's the Mission Investors Exchange, which was one of these early social impact exchange programs. And catalyzed a lot of the impact investment market and sustainable development, business development market. They're also very Catholic too. And they also have this foster care component, which is a target for pay for success. So it's just important to know these players. The Annie Casey Foundation interfaces with Strive Together, which is this the collective impact program out of Cincinnati. But in thinking about like tracking, right? Like UPS is really good at tracking things. Right? Like ensuring delivery and supply chain. And really what we need to envision is that blockchain identity systems and being processed, whether it's through education, whether it's through healthcare or some other system, is about supply chain tracking. Like human beings are the supply chain. So I think that's most of it.
That's interesting.
And you wouldn't think, like that's Annie Casey Foundation is not one of the foundations that like comes to mind immediately, but they're very important to this in this space.
Well, and it seems like Amazon is another one that's gotta be playing a huge role in.
Well,
a
you
lot
know,
of
they had that how much money? 100 billion? Like this investment in homelessness, right? A couple years ago, and pre-K. And they were going to do Montessori preschool, right? And it sounds great, right? Like the Montessori brand is like, oh, That's what the rich people send their kids to Montessori pre-K, right? But essentially what Montessori is, it's great for impact investing because it's individual, right? It's the individual person going off and doing their individual things in their own self-directed way. So there are Montessori pre-K programs in the Boston area. It's a franchise called Wildflower connected to MIT, where they put Internet of Things sensors in all the kids' slippers and they track them around the school. So that's like the human capital piece. They're like, oh, but we think social relations are important. So we'd like to track all of the children, see who they talk to, see how they interact with the teacher, see what part of the room they're in. Are they playing in the block area too long? We can put them all on the dashboard and make sure that they're engineered properly. And that's what these Bezos Montessori schools are very likely going to be.
Crazy.
It is crazy.
What would you say to people that are watching this, that just... What do you think people should do, or what would your appeal be to the world?
I think we have to fight to be out of the panopticon. I think we have to resist them wanting to make us into a commodity, a data commodity. I think the goal will be to frame liberation as that we will sell ourselves. And we will, if we are just really good at branding ourselves, that we will come out ahead against our neighbors. And I think that we need solidarity. Like, we need to oppose digital identity systems. I will say, I don't think I mentioned before, but at the national meeting of the NAACP last summer, they passed a resolution opposing linking blockchain identity to any public benefit system. Okay, so that was passed at the national meeting in Detroit, opposing linking things to SNAP and housing or tying it into incarceration or any of these things. And I think that's really relevant right now with these blockchain potential health passports. So we need to stop digital identity. I think we need to stop 5G. We don't need a world where humans are redundant. And we need to understand this not in a partisan way and not in a nationalist way. Right now, it is the masses of humanity against the billionaires. I'm wearing a shirt, Poor People's Army. I organize locally with the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign. They have been working on welfare rights. They do not take outside money, and it is led by the poor. And I am allied with that because I believe that this system is coming after all people, and we have a lot to learn from people who have been resisting these systems of domination for years and years. We need to stand in solidarity with one another, and we need to do that. We need to understand that our struggle is the struggle of people around the world. And I'm sitting here as someone, who has the benefit of mostly owning a home, having somewhat stable employment. But I can see where this is heading, and where this is heading is towards anti-life. And so I think if we can be very clear about that, and I'm sort of appealing to all the people who care for liberation and care for people who are the vulnerable among us, and I'm trying to appeal to, the Berrigans of today, like the liberation and people who are willing to put like peaceful hearts forward in a very insistent and direct way and to challenge these authorities. Because I believe that our spirits together are very powerful things, and that we can join together to do this work. And I'm under no impression that it's going to be some quick resolution. If it were, we wouldn't actually be addressing the problem, because this problem is tied to the doctrine of discovery and is at least 400 years or more in the making. It's not a quick fix, but it's the work that has to be done. So I guess just putting a call out to all those who see that work. I think addressing the 5G situation, stopping the fourth industrial revolution, stopping digital identity are the key pieces that I see as the levers that we need to engage in right now.